We continue in our exposition of Genesis chapter 24. We're now at verse 10. Genesis 24, verses 10 to 14. Then the servant took 10 camels from the camels of his master and set out with a variety of good things of his master's in his hand. And he arose and went to Mesopotamia, to the city of Nahor. And he made the camels kneel down outside the city by the well of water at evening time, the time when women go out to draw water. And he said, O Lord, the God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today and show loving kindness to my master Abraham. Behold, I am standing by the spring, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Now may it be that the girl to whom I say, please let down your jar so that I may drink, and who answers, drink, and I will water your camels also, may she be the one whom you have appointed for your servant Isaac. And by this I shall know that you have shown loving kindness to my master. In verse 10, how many camels are mentioned in verse 10? 10. 10 camels are mentioned. He is taking not only these 10 camels, but as we read later, he has other men, at least two men, accompanying him with all these camels and all these goods to go to the place where Abraham used to live in Mesopotamia, to the city of Nahor. He's taking 10 camels there. And then in verses 11 and following, we have the servant of Abraham praying a prayer, and it is a silent prayer. It is a silent prayer. In verse 15, it says, it came about before he had finished speaking. And then we find in verse 24:45, before I had finished speaking in my heart, he prayed this silent prayer. And it's important to note that it's a silent prayer because no woman approaching heard what he prayed. So that the woman doesn't know what he prayed or if he's praying. It was a silent prayer. He prayed it in his heart. Therefore, no woman could say, well, this man has a lot of wealth. He must be on a mission. I want to get to know him and see why he's here so that I can have some of what he has. There was no way that that could happen because it was a silent prayer. Now, what do we notice in his prayer? First, in verse 12. In verse 12, what does the servant pray?
He knows that if the success is to be had, it's from God.
Yes, he knows if there is any success to be had, it will be from God. Because he says, please grant me success today and show loving kindness to my master Abraham. The servant is a righteous man. Abraham is a righteous man. Therefore, he's praying according to God's will for success. Is there any significance in, or any more references in the Bible related to asking the Lord for success, asking the Lord to answer according to his word, according to his promise? Any in the scriptures? Yes. James chapter 1. James chapter 4.
13-17.
James chapter 4. James 4, 13-17. James 4, 13. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow, we shall go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. Yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and also do this or that. But as it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, to one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin.
Yes, so instead of us having our wisdom and try to say we are going to do this and that, we should be saying always, if the Lord wills, and then if it is His will, He will make it happen.
Correct. Correct. We should always be saying, if the Lord wills. And if He wills, then it will happen.
Yes. Verse 16, we don't do so is we are boasting and we are arrogant and it's evil.
Yes. We are. If we don't do it, we're boasting, we are arrogant, and it is evil. And since we are in James, James chapter 4, verses 1 to 4, James 4, 1 to 4. Remember, we said that both the servant and Abraham are righteous. And notice here, James 4, verse 1. What is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? Is not the source your pleasures that wage war in your members? You lust and do not have, so you commit murder. And you are envious and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, so that you may spend it on your pleasures. You adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. In verse 3, he says, you ask and do not receive because you ask with wrong motives so that you may spend it on your pleasures. It's not a wrong motive to have success in finding a wife. That's not a wrong motive. It's a good motive, so it could not be a sinful prayer. Further, James chapter 1, verses 5 to 8. James 1, 5. But if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all generously and without reproach, and it will be given to him. But let him ask in faith without any doubting, for the one who doubts is like the surf of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. For let not that man expect that he will receive anything from the Lord, being a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. If we lack wisdom, we should ask God. And then God will generously grant his wisdom to us. Not asking for his wisdom means we are double-minded and unstable in all our ways. Okay, then, in Genesis 24, verses 13 and 14. What do we see in Genesis 24, 13 and 14, where the servant is presenting a scenario that he desires to come true? What is significant about this part of the prayer?
So we already know the servant is looking for a believer. But there's a way to know if the woman you are looking at is a believer.
Okay. We know he's looking for a believer in the gospel, but there is a way to discern whether a woman is really a believer. And what is that way that he is using to discern?
It's by her fruit of being selfless and industrious and serving others.
Yes, the fruit of being selfless, industrious, and serving others. Where do you see her being selfless, industrious, and serving others?
In how she waters, not only she first approaches the man and asks for his jar, and then also, without being prompted, asks to water the camels.
Okay, without being prompted, that she would offer herself to water the camels. What's the big deal about her watering the camels. What would be the significance of that? Because camels drink a lot of water. Camels, what's that?
There's 10 camels.
Yes, and there are 10, in verse 10, it says 10 camels. 10 camels. And if her jar is able to hold 1 gallon, camels typically drink 20 to 30 gallons to fill up. 20 to 30. If we say each camel drank 20 gallons of the 10, that's 200 gallons, which means that she had to put her jar down 200 times for the animals to drink. She had to do that about 200 times. And it doesn't say specifically whether she had her maids with her. She may have had them, but the narrative is presenting it as she herself is doing this. Because if she had maids, she then told her maids, and they listened to her voice. They obeyed her. But it doesn't say that. It's also presenting her as quickly doing this and that, such as in verse 20. Verse 20 says, "So she quickly emptied her jar into the trough and ran back to the well to draw, and she drew for all his camels." It's presenting it as though Rebekah herself is doing it. Wouldn't it be easy for a woman who has maids to say, "Maid Susie, please go do that. Maid Sarah, go over there." Right? It would be easy for that to happen. It's easy to bark orders. But it's harder to actually do the work. And he's looking for a woman who's actually doing the work. What else do we see in 13 and 14? Anything more?
We could also contrast this evidence of faith with what the world presents as faith, in quotations, that is a profession or being the daughter of a pastor, or these random ways that the world presents as evidence of faith.
Okay.
That's not at all what the godly man is.
Yes, in the world and in worldly churches, evidence of faith is a simple profession. I say I believe, I was baptized, I go to church, or I'm the daughter of a pastor. So automatically people assume, okay, then she's a believer. But that's not the case. The world looks at it that way, and the worldly Christian looks at it that way, but not the Bible. Do we have any New Testament evidence that the wife ought to be as diligent as Rebekah? New Testament evidence that the wife ought to be as diligent, as selfless as Rebekah.
Colossians 3:18 and then 23 and 24.
Colossians chapter 3, verse 18. 3:18. Wives, be subject to your husbands as is fitting in the Lord. And the next references?
Verses 23 and 24.
3:23. Whatever you do, do your work heartily as for the Lord rather than for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance. It is the Lord Christ whom you serve.
So it includes wives, husbands, children, fathers, and slaves, and the people that should be working heartily as unto the Lord rather than for men. So the wives as well should be working heartily.
Yes, all of these groups of people should be working heartily as for the Lord rather than for men, because we serve the Lord Christ. And this includes, in verse 18, wives in subjection to their husbands, as is fitting in the Lord. To be subject to your husbands is her way, her immediate way of obeying the Lord. Obeying the husband is obeying the Lord. Now, obeying the husband doesn't mean when the husband tempts you or tells you to sin, of course, when the husband is telling you to sin, if the husband says, honey, let's go get drunk tonight, then that's a sin. Or, honey, let's go take some drugs. Well, that's a sin. Honey, let's go commit adultery. That's a sin. Let's go lie. Let's go steal something in the store, honey. If the husband says that to the wife, then no, she's not supposed to do any of that. But otherwise, she is supposed to obey her husband. Be subject to your husbands. And do it with eagerness, like Rebecca was showing with the servant of Abraham, with eagerness. She didn't complain. There wasn't any drudgery. She wasn't whining about it. She wasn't griping about it. She had the right attitude. That's evident in the narrative of Genesis 24. Yes, more in the New Testament.
Yes, two references. 1 Timothy 5, verse 8.
1 Timothy 5:8. But if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever.
Yes, so this is in the context of widows. They are supposed to provide for the family. But God is also expecting, if he's expecting this of widows, he is expecting this of those who are not widows, who have their husbands, that they provide with food, meal, with everything the husband needs for.
Yeah, verse 8 is applicable to those who are not widows. Verse 8, that they should be behaving this way toward the widows. But this is necessary within families for others to help their own widows. Otherwise, they deny the faith and are worse than unbelievers.
Even if a husband, you can have a lazy husband, he must provide for you. So this is the... if we do not provide for the household, we are worse than unbelievers. And then Luke 4:39.
Luke chapter 4.
Yes.
Luke chapter 4, verse 39. Luke 4:39. Let's read 38 and 39. Luke 4:38. And he arose and left the synagogue and entered Simon's home. Now Simon's mother-in-law was suffering from a high fever, and they made request of him on her behalf. And standing over her, he rebuked the fever, and it left her. And she immediately arose and began to wait on them.
But even if she wasn't, wives who claim to be believers and don't have this attitude, they should be ashamed that a non-believer has this attitude toward.
Yes. She, after being healed, she immediately arose and waited on them. If she was a believer, and it's likely the case she was, but even if she wasn't a believer, this unbeliever is doing what current believers don't do. And speaking of that, another example is Acts chapter 16. The same on hospitality. Acts chapter 16. This is Lydia. Lydia, she became a believer. And right after she became a believer, this is what she says. Acts 16:15. And when she and her household had been baptized, she urged us, saying, "If you have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come into my house and stay." And she prevailed upon us. It tells us that while Paul and Luke were still there with Lydia and her household, she believed, her household believed, and what did she do before Paul and Luke left her city? She urged us, and she prevailed upon us. She urged us, and she prevailed upon us. She insisted in showing hospitality to Paul and Luke. She says, if you have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come into my house and stay. That was also immediate indication of her faith, true faith. In her case, the moment she believed, she wanted to do this. Any more in the New Testament? One or two more passages of the New Testament. Yes, it's in the book of Luke, Luke 10, 38 to 42. Martha was diligently making preparations for the Lord. And that part is right and good. The problem Martha had was she didn't prioritize listening to his word as Mary did. Mary prioritized listening to his word. Not that Mary was lazy, but Martha, though she was doing the right thing, she had the wrong attitude. She was doing the right thing with the wrong attitude, and Christ had to rebuke her because she's basically accusing the Lord of sin. Because she's saying, Lord, do you not care? My sister has left me to do all the serving alone. Lord, do you not care is an accusation against the Lord of sin. Accusation of sin. But she's the one sinning, not the Lord, and not Mary either. She was doing the right thing, but it was with the wrong attitude and at the wrong time. She should have been listening like Mary was. Okay, Titus chapter 2, Titus chapter 2, 3 to 5. Titus 2, verse 3. Older women likewise are to be reverent in their behavior, not malicious gossips, nor enslaved to much wine, teaching what is good, that they may encourage the young women to love their husbands, to love their children, to be sensible, pure, workers at home, kind, being subject to their own husbands, that the word of God may not be dishonored.
In terms of industriousness, here he mentions the workers at home.
Yes. Workers at home. This is contrary to our culture. The world says it's not good to be a worker at home. You should have a career. You should have your own profession. You should make money. You should make a lot of money. You don't need to have children. But if you want to have one, only have one. Maybe two. And then their jaws gape if you say you're pregnant for the third or fourth or fifth time. As though you are crazy. That's the way the world looks at it. And there is no such thing as overpopulation. That is a farce. It's a big lie. There is no overpopulation in the world. And for that matter, anywhere in the world. Japan and Singapore are more densely populated than some of the most populous nations in the world. More densely populated than the most populous nations in the world. And yet, there is no utter poverty in Singapore. There's no utter poverty in Japan. In fact, those kinds of countries are about to collapse if they don't have enough children. And yet, they are very densely populated, but they need more children so that their economies do not collapse. All right, thank you. Let's now move to verses 15 to 21. Genesis 24, 15 to 21. And it came about, before he had finished speaking, that behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor, came out with her jar on her shoulder. And the girl was very beautiful, a virgin, and no man had had relations with her. And she went down to the spring and filled her jar and came up. Then the servant ran to meet her and said, please let me drink a little water from your jar. And she said, drink, my lord. And she quickly lowered her jar to her hand and gave him a drink. Now when she had finished giving him a drink, she said, I will draw also, for your camels until they have finished drinking." So she quickly emptied her jar into the trough and ran back to the well to draw, and she drew for all his camels. Meanwhile, the man was gazing at her in silence to know whether the Lord had made his journey successful or not. 15, we've already mentioned, according to verse 45, that this was a silent prayer, because it says in verse 45, he was speaking in his heart. So when he was doing this, while he was doing it, before he had finished, it says, "Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor, came out with her jar on her shoulder." What is significant about this phrase, "Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor"? That phrase, "born to Bethuel." Born to Bethuel.
Linking back to 24:4.
In 24:4.
Yeah. "That you will go to my country and to my relatives and to my wife."
Okay. Yes. Okay. That is one aspect. That's the factual part that he actually did come across. He actually did come across one of the relatives of Abraham. That ended up happening. Yes, it is linking back to verse 4 in terms of the identity of the girl, Rebekah. Correct. But particularly, born to. What does it mean to be born to?
Is it when the Bible says, as today we have feminism, and they say, "Is a woman will say, 'It's my son, it's my daughter. I suffer, you didn't suffer.'" But when the Bible speaks of marriage, having a child, it says, "She bore him a son."
Yes. Yes. Feminism makes it seem as though the child is the woman's child, and she looks at it that way. Her attitude is wrong and sinful, and they prop her up like that. But actually, the child is coming from the man, and she is bearing the man's child, her husband's child. That's the way the Bible looks at it, and that's the way science looks at it. Science and biology, that's the way it happens. There is no seed in the woman. The man has the seed. And so the man's seed is placed in the woman, and then the woman, her egg and fertilization and all, it receives the seed, and she conceives, and then she bears. Even today we say she's bearing a child, right? So she is carrying whose child? The husband's child. Yes. It says this also in Genesis 21. Genesis 21:1-3. Genesis 21:1. "Then the Lord took note of Sarah, as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had promised. So Sarah conceived and bore a son to Abraham." Conceived and bore a son to Abraham in his old age, at the appointed time of which God had spoken to him. And Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore to him, Isaac. Sarah bore to Abraham. Now, a feminist might say, "Well, that's just the Bible. A woman, she's not going to look at it that way. She shouldn't look at it that way." Well, she should look at it that way, biblically speaking. And in fact, our woman here, Rebekah, she looked at it that way. Look at what she says in 24:24. Verse 24, Rebecca actually looks at it this way. 24:24, and she said to him, I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor. Whom she bore to Nahor. Which shows that she is scientifically astute and she is theologically astute. She knows what the truth is. Rebecca does. That's why she's speaking this way. Matthew chapter 1. Matthew chapter 1. Matthew chapter 1. Okay. Matthew 1, 1 to 16. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. To Abraham was born Isaac, and to Isaac, Jacob, and to Jacob, Judah and his brothers. And to Judah were born Perez and Zerah by Tamar. And to Perez was born Hezron, and to Hezron, Ram, and to Ram was born Amminadab, and to Amminadab, Nashon, and to Nashon, Salmon, and to Salmon was born Boaz by Ruth, and to Boaz was born Obed by Ruth, and to Obed, Jesse, and to Jesse was born David the king, and to David was born Solomon by her who had been the wife of Uriah, and to Solomon was born Rehoboam, and to Rehoboam Abijah, and to Abijah Asa, and to Asa was born Jehoshaphat, and to Jehoshaphat Joram, and to Joram Uzziah, and to Uzziah was born Jotham, and to Jotham Ahaz, and to Ahaz Hezekiah, and to Hezekiah was born Manasseh, and to Manasseh Amon, and to Amon Josiah, and to Josiah were born Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the deportation to Babylon. And after the deportation to Babylon, to Jeconiah was born Shealtiel, and to Shealtiel Zerubbabel, and to Zerubbabel was born Abiud, and to Abiud Eliakim, and to Eliakim Azor, and to Azor was born Zadok, and to Zadok Achim, and to Achim Eliud, and to Eliud was born Eleazar, and to Eleazar Matan, and to Matan Jacob, and to Jacob was born Joseph, the husband of Mary, by whom was born Jesus, who is called Christ.
Yes, so they mentioned the fathers, even though some women are mentioned, but the main authority of the household was the
yes.
Father.
Yeah, and the seed, the line of the seed is through the man, and that's why it constantly says to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, so forth. And also, whenever the woman is mentioned, such as verse 3, it says, by Tamar. Verse 5, by Rahab. Verse 5, by Ruth. And in verse 6, by her who had been the wife of Uriah. Right? It says, by her. Born to Abraham by Sarah. Exodus chapter 21. Exodus chapter 21, verse 22. 21:22. And if men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child, so that she has her children, her child come out, yet there is no injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. But if there is injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise.
Yes, so the woman's husband is the one who
yes, the woman's husband is the one who is to demand recompense or punishment for the other who caused injury to the child.
Yes.
And that is showing the child belongs to him. Therefore, he is responsible for acting righteously to bring recompense to injury. Next, let's go to verse 16. Genesis 24, 16. And the girl was very beautiful, a virgin, and no man had had relations with her. And she went down to the spring and filled her jar and came up. What does this say about her purity? Her purity. First question, what does it imply or say related to her purity?
She was a godly woman.
A godly woman, why?
Because she was a virgin.
A virgin. And in case we do not understand or understand the significance of it and put emphasis on it, it says, and no man had had relations with her. It's emphasizing that fact. She's a virgin, and Moses could have left it at that. But he wanted to emphasize, she's a virgin, and let me clarify what I'm talking about. No man had had relations with her. What does that say about how women and men should be before they are married? Is this the way it should be?
It should be pure.
It should be pure. Do we have any New Testament evidence? Or is this an onerous, burdensome, encumbering Old Testament regulation? But in the New Testament, since God is a God of grace, it doesn't matter. If you fornicate before marriage, it's okay. God doesn't care because he's very gracious. Is it a doctrine of the New Testament? 1 Corinthians chapter 7. 1 Corinthians 7, 1 to 5. 1 Corinthians 7, verse 1. Now concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. But because of immoralities, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does, and likewise also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Stop depriving one another, except by agreement for a time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer and come together again, lest Satan tempt you because of your lack of self-control.
In verses 2 through 5, he explains that the marriage is the only context in which there should be relations. But it starts with verse 1, where he states that it's good for a man not to touch a woman. So outside the context of marriage, that type of contact should not happen.
Yes, outside of marriage, that kind of contact should not happen. And when that contact happens, what happens, verse 2? Immoralities. And the original word is the word for sexual sin. He doesn't mean lying and cheating and idolatry when he says immorality in this context. And usually it is sexual immorality. Therefore, what the scripture also calls fornication, and the word in the original language is the word from which we get the word, our English word, fornication. And even the English word pornography comes from that same Greek word, immorality. So that should not take place. Instead, the men and the women should have their own wife and own husband. And in marriage, that's how they are to supply one another's needs and not deprive each other in marriage. That means outside of marriage, it's a sin.
1 Corinthians 6.
1 Corinthians 6, 9 and 10. Or do you not know that the unrighteous shall not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. Neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor effeminate, nor homosexuals, nor thieves, nor the covetous, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor swindlers shall inherit the kingdom of God.
Fornicators, that's what...
Yes, he says fornicators, the same word we find in chapter 7. And also, he explicitly mentions adulterers. A fornicator is one who has sex outside of marriage. An adulterer is one who is married and then has sex with another woman, not his wife. That's adultery. But fornication is any sex outside of marriage. And this is made explicit in 1 Corinthians 6:9 because he's using two different words and translated differently. Though fornication could generally be speaking of any sexual sin, at times, like 1 Corinthians 6:9, it's talking specifically about premarital sin, sexual sin. Okay, Hebrews chapter 13 also uses both words. Hebrews 13:4. Let marriage be held in honor among all, and let the marriage bed be undefiled. For fornicators and adulterers, God will judge. Fornicators and adulterers. Two kinds of sexual sin. Revelation chapter 14, verse 1. Revelation 14:1-5. And I looked, and behold, the Lamb was standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his name and the name of his Father written on their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven, like the sound of many waters, and like the sound of loud thunder. And the voice which I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps. And they sang a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and the elders. And no one could learn the song except the 144,000 who had been purchased from the earth. These are the ones who have not been defiled with women, for they have kept themselves chaste. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been purchased from among men as first fruits to God and to the Lamb. And no lie was found in their mouth. They are blameless.
Here, these saints that are being described, those with Christ, in verse 4, have not been defiled with women, for they have kept themselves chaste, and saying they have not been defiled by sexual morality with women. And it says that also in the same verse, it says that these have been purchased from among men as first fruits to God and to the Lamb. And verse 5, and no lie was found in their mouth, they are blameless. It makes me think of Ephesians 5, where Christ is described as presenting the church as pure.
Yes. Yes. Ephesians 5:26 says that the church is to be presented to Christ without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, blameless. And then in verse 4, it might be distorted to mean that he's referencing single men. But then, is he saying that only single men go to heaven? No, it's ridiculous. He means have not been defiled with women sexually. They don't practice sexual immorality, nor do they practice lying. That's what he means in verses 4 and 5. 2 Corinthians 11:4. verse 1. I wish that you would bear with me in a little foolishness, but indeed you are bearing with me. For I am jealous for you with a godly jealousy. For I betrothed you to one husband, that to Christ I might present you as a pure virgin. But I am afraid, lest as the serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, your minds should be led astray from the simplicity and purity of devotion to Christ. For if one comes and preaches another Jesus, whom we have not preached, or you receive a different spirit, whom you have not received, or a different gospel, which you have not accepted, you bear this beautifully.
Yes, so in verse 2, it says, I betrothed you to one husband, that Christ I might present you as a pure virgin. That's the symbolic marriage between Christ and the church. We should be as a virgin, pure.
Yes. We as the church should be pure, just like girls, women, young women, they should be pure and only married to their husband. And the church should be pure, only married to Christ, not married to Christ and other gods, only to Christ.
Yes. And in verse 4, also it refutes the heretics who say you can be a Christian and a fornicator. That's a different gospel, preaches another Jesus. Say, no, you can know Jesus and be a fornicator, but you can't.
No.
But people love that. That's what it says. People love to hear that. They bear it beautifully.
Yes.
Because of their sins.
They love to hear the falsehoods.
Yes.
They bear it beautifully. Yes. But that's not the way of Christ. All right, now, back to Genesis 24:16, it says, Moses records, the girl was very beautiful. The girl was very beautiful. Does this mean? What does this mean about seeking for a wife and beauty? Does this mean that it is good to seek for a beautiful wife? Or does it mean that it's irrelevant?
It means it's good.
Means it's good. Why do we know it's good? That it means it's good.
Well, the passage is giving an honorable description of Rebecca, and this is one of the things mentioned about her. But also the servant who is searching for her, he is faithful to Abraham in knowing what needs to be, what he should be looking for. And this is being stated specifically by Moses.
Yes, we know Moses is stating it, and the servant of Abraham would have received instructions on what to find, what to seek in a woman, and therefore it has to be taken in a positive light, since the whole passage is highlighting the godliness of Rebekah.
In verse 17 it says, and the servant ran to meet her, but what was described about her in verse 16, the only thing the servant could have known about her is her beauty. He could not have known her virginity, or that she would be the one that would have the industrious nature to serve camels and him as well. So all he saw and he ran to her was her beauty.
Excellent point. It says in verse 17 that the servant ran to meet her, but he could not have known at that point that she was a virgin. He could not have known who she was exactly, her family background, and he could not have known that she was going to offer the camels to drink water. He could not have known any. The only thing he could have known was that she was very beautiful. So he ran to meet her and then to engage and begin this dialogue.
Song of Solomon 115.
Okay, other verses on the beauty of the woman. Song of Solomon. Song of Solomon, chapter 1, verse 15. How beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves.
So it's good and natural for the husband to desire the beauty of his wife.
Yes, it's good and natural for the husband to desire the beauty of his wife.
He says it twice.
He says it twice, yes, in the same verse. But what about the wife or the bride to her groom? Look at verse 16. Verse 16. How handsome you are, my beloved, and so pleasant. Indeed, our couch is luxuriant. The beams of our houses are cedars, our rafters, cypresses. It's mutual. Handsomeness of the man, the beauty of the woman.
Also, but, Song of Solomon 2, verse 10.
Song of Solomon 2, 10. My beloved responded and said to me, "Arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along."
2:13.
The fig tree has ripened its figs, and the vines in blossom have given forth their fragrance. Arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along.
Chapter 4, verse 1.
How beautiful you are, my darling, how beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats that have descended from Mount Gilead.
Chapter 4, verse 7.
You are altogether beautiful, my darling, and there is no blemish in you.
Chapter 5, verses 9 to 10.
Actually, 4:10. How about 4:10? 4:10 says, "How beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your oils than all kinds of spices." Then what?
Chapter 5, verses 9 and 10.
Chapter 5, 9 and 10. 5:9. What kind of beloved is your beloved, O most beautiful among women? What kind of beloved is your beloved, that thus you adjure us? My beloved is dazzling and ruddy, outstanding among 10,000. His head is like gold, pure gold. His locks are like clusters of dates and black as a raven. Chapter 6, verse 1. Where has your beloved gone, O most beautiful among women? Where has your beloved turned, that we may seek him with you?
6:4.
You are as beautiful as Tirzah, my darling, as lovely as Jerusalem, as awesome as an army with banners.
Chapter 6, verses 8 and 10.
Chapter 6, verse 8. There are 60 queens and 80 concubines and maidens without number. But my dove, my perfect one, is unique. She is her mother's only daughter. She is the pure child of the one who bore her. The maidens saw her and called her blessed. The queens and the concubines also. And they praised her, saying, "Who is this that grows like the dawn, as beautiful as the full moon, as pure as the sun, as awesome as an army with banners?"
And then chapter 7 and 6.
Chapter 7, let's read 7:1. How beautiful are your feet in sandals, O prince's daughter. The curves of your hips are like jewels, the work of the hands of an artist. And then 7:6.
Yes.
7:6. How beautiful and how delightful you are, my love, with all your charms.
I'm sure I missed some, but like you just referenced, but the main point is that it's talking about the beauty of the woman, the beauty of the man, and then specifically in chapter 5, verses 9 to 10, when it says, "Oh, most beautiful among women," and then it says about the man, "Outstanding among 10,000. So it's obvious that their traits and what they look like, their appearance, it's very beautiful, it's very attractive, and it's very noticeable.
Yes. On both sides, it's mutual. They are looking at one another's beauty and commending it and appreciating it and desiring it.
Genesis 12:14.
Genesis chapter 12. Genesis chapter 12, verse 14. 12:14. And it came about when Abram came into Egypt, the Egyptians saw that the woman was very beautiful. And verse 11, see now, I know that you are a beautiful woman.
Also, in Song of Solomon as well, the things that he mentions too, and that she mentions, but like the different descriptions about pointing out the hair, the teeth, even the hips, all of those factors. So just another factor of the attraction and the beauty aspect of it.
Yes. He points out details about why she is beautiful.
Yes.
Let's also go to 1 Samuel chapter 16. 1 Samuel 16. Samuel the prophet is commissioned by the Lord to anoint David as the next king among the sons of Jesse. Samuel goes to the house of Jesse. And this is what happens. 1 Samuel 16:6. Then it came about when they entered that he looked at Eliab and thought, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. But the Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance or at the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For God sees not as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. From this, many falsely conclude that Samuel, he saw the firstborn son of Jesse, Eliab, and thought, surely this has to be the one, the firstborn, that maybe the oldest, most mature looking, maybe also very handsome. It doesn't say, but it is implied because God says, don't look at his appearance. I know his heart. You don't know his heart. You see his appearance. And many times people falsely say, God therefore doesn't care about our appearance. And some people, a lot of people, take it too far. Men are disheveled. They don't comb their hair. They don't cut their hair. They don't take care of their face. They don't take care of their clothing. They don't make sure to take a bath. They wear smelly clothes. They don't wear deodorant. Nothing like that. So because God doesn't care about the appearance, they say. And the same with women. Men also become fat. Women become fat before they're married. And then they become unattractive. And the women don't take care of their hair. They don't take care of their face or their clothing. They just wear whatever they feel like wearing. Like pajamas in public. Right? Men and women wear pajamas in public these days. So the appearance doesn't matter. Even the Bible says, look at this. 1 Samuel 16:7. God doesn't look at the appearance. Is that what he means? No. How do we know he doesn't mean that appearance doesn't matter at all? Turn or continue in 1 Samuel 16, verse 12. So he sent and brought him in. That is David. And David was brought in. Now he, David, was ruddy, with beautiful eyes, and a handsome appearance. And the Lord said, arise, anoint him, for this is he. Why? Why David? David had both inner beauty and outer beauty. And God says, this is the man I want. And when he chooses a man with outer beauty, it's not at the neglect of his inner beauty. But it doesn't mean inner beauty is all that God is concerned about. You don't need to take care of yourself, or it doesn't matter if you are ruddy, beautiful eyes, handsome appearance. None of that matters to God. It does matter to God. Didn't he create David that way? And doesn't he create handsome men and beautiful women? So why can't we appreciate that and honor that? and look for that. Therefore, verse 7 isn't saying our appearance does not matter to God or beauty doesn't matter to God. That's not what verse 7 is teaching. Verse 7 is teaching, don't look at the appearance and forget to ask yourself, what is in that man's heart? Or what is in that woman's heart? That question must be answered. And that's what we've been doing with Rebecca, have we not? We've been considering her inner beauty so far in the chapter. Her inner beauty. Therefore, inner beauty does matter and it is of utmost importance, but it doesn't mean that outer beauty is irrelevant. Is that clear from the beauty? Verse on beauty. Okay, then let's finish this section. We've already commented on verse 17, where the servant ran to meet her because he saw her beauty, that she was very beautiful. And he runs to meet her, and he is polite. Please let me drink a little water from your jar. And she said, drink, my Lord. What is significant in her answer? Drink, my Lord.
Respect.
Yes, she respected him. Even though he was a stranger, she doesn't say, drink, dude. Hey, guy. Hey, guy. Hey, dude. Hey, man. She doesn't do anything like that. She says, drink, my Lord. Which would mean an equivalent in our English would be, drink, sir. Drink, sir. And she does that. And as though some might think that's insignificant, but it's not. If we cross-reference 1 Peter 3:6 with Genesis 18:12, Peter notes that Sarah referred to her own husband as my Lord, and that showed her godliness. It was an evidence of Sarah's godliness that she addressed her husband as my Lord. Genesis 18:12 and 1 Peter 3, 1 to 6. And particularly verse 6. Okay, then there's another significant part of verse 18. 24:18. And she quickly lowered her jar to her hand and gave him a drink. What is significant in 18? She did not hesitate. She did not hesitate to do it. It says quickly. She did it quickly. There was no griping, no complaining, no murmuring, grumbling. Oh, do I have to do this for the stranger? There's nothing like that. She quickly did it. Does God expect us to have quick obedience? Does God expect us to have quick obedience? Or does God say, well, you know, this was the first time you heard about it, so take your time, pray about it. You know, take your time, pray about it, think about it. And, you know, God's not going to rush you. He's not going to force you. You know, he's very gentle and very loving. He's very soft. God doesn't expect you to do things immediately, does he?
Psalm 119, verse 60.
Psalm 119, 60. I hastened and did not delay to keep your commandments. I hastened and did not delay to keep your commandments. Earlier, did we not read how Lydia, upon her conversion, before Paul and Luke could leave her city, before even leave her presence, she urged them to stay in her house, and she prevailed upon them. Which means she had to have done that quickly, immediately. And speaking of Acts 16, there's another example of immediate obedience. And this is Acts chapter 16. Acts 16. This is the jailer. After the jailer hears the gospel from Paul and Silas, we begin at verse 33. 16:33. And he took them that very hour of the night and washed their wounds, and immediately he was baptized, he and all his household. And he brought them into his house and set food before them and rejoiced greatly, having believed in God with his whole household. What happens immediately? There's actually a couple of things that happen. He believes. He's immediately baptized. He tells his household about it. He brings them into his household to accommodate them and sets food before them. That's all immediate. And rejoice greatly, having believed in God with his whole household. And remember, this is happening in the middle of the night, because it came about at midnight that they were praying and singing hymns of praise to God, Acts 16:25 says. And then the earthquake occurred. Then the jail is opened. And then the jailer is concerned, and he says, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" They preach to him. He believes. He's immersed. He tells his household. The household believes. And then all of them entertain with hospitality, putting food before Paul and Silas in their house. And this is happening in the night, in the middle of the night, immediately, quickly, it's happening. And earlier we referred to Luke 4:38-39. After the mother-in-law of Peter was healed, she got up and then and there began to wait on Peter. Yes?
Proverbs.
Yes.
Proverbs 6.
Proverbs chapter 6.
6-11.
Proverbs 6:6. Proverbs 6:6-11. Go to the ant, O sluggard, observe her ways and be wise, which, having no chief, officer, or ruler, prepares her food in the summer and gathers her provision in the harvest. How long will you lie down, O sluggard? When will you arise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and your poverty will come in like a vagabond, and your need like an armed man. Yes, God compares a sluggard, lazy people, to the ant, a very small bug, a small insect, and says, why can't you learn from that insect and how busy the insect is and quick to do this and that? If we see how tiny an ant is and how fast it's moving for its size, it's going here and there, it's going very fast, different places to collect food. Proverbs 26:14. As the door turns on its hinges, so does the sluggard on his bed. Yes, it is. He is compared, the sluggard is compared to a door that is opening slowly, and the sluggard is so lazy and probably also a glutton, because sluggishness and gluttony go together. And if your stomach is so full all the time, you find it hard to walk around. You find it hard to stand up and sit down. You'd rather just lie down and just turn from side to side on your bed. Isn't that what fat, lazy people do? She was not like that. She acted quickly. Acted quickly. Which also means it's highly the case that she was not a fat young woman. Look also at 28. Then the girl ran and told her mother's household about these things. If she were fat, she couldn't run like this. And if she were fat, she would have been exhausted maybe after the first camel. In watering the first camel, she would have been exhausted. But she was able to water all of them, all 10. Let's go on. 24:19 of Genesis. Now when she had finished giving him a drink, she said, I will draw also for your camels until they have finished drinking. What is in verse 19? What do we know from verse 19?
Every answer is from the Lord.
Every answer is from the Lord. Proverbs 16:1. The plans of the heart belong to man, but the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. Her answer came from the Lord. It came from the Lord, which also means it was not initiated or not prompted by the servant of Abraham. That's what's missing in verse 19. It doesn't say it explicitly, but like we just read in Proverbs 16:1, it had to be from God, because it's not the servant telling her, listen, would you also water all of my camels? He never asked her for that. Therefore, whatever came from her mouth was actually coming from her heart, and God put it in her heart for her mouth to speak that way. Then verse 20. So she quickly emptied her jar into the trough and ran back to the well to draw, and she drew for all his camels. More of her diligence and hastening to obey God. She quickly emptied and she ran back. She's running here, back and forth, back and forth. She's running to the well to draw, and she drew for all his camels. All of the 10 camels. Like we've said before, if she was making sure that they were fully watered, she was doing a lot of work. Probably about 200 gallons. But even if we said that conservative estimate is too liberal, what about 100 gallons? Where is the woman who would have done this 100 times? 100 times. Where is she? And so now, having understood this about her hard work, her diligence, to a stranger, remember this, is again to a stranger, because somebody could say, well, it was her relative, or this was the servant of her relative, or this is my friend. well, this is my son. This is my daughter. So I'm going to do that. Well, that's not the case here. This is to a stranger. A stranger who has an obvious need. Hebrews 13. Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 2. 13:2. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by this some have entertained angels without knowing it.
This is an instruction from one of our apostles, so it's godliness.
Yes, this is from one of the apostles, therefore it is godliness to do so, to help a stranger with an obvious need. Verse 21. Meanwhile, the man was gazing at her in silence to know whether the Lord had made his journey successful or not. He gazes in silence to discern whether the Lord had made his journey successful or not. Genesis chapter 38.
Yes. No, it's the girl who was raped.
Oh, the girl who was raped?
Yes.
Yes, okay. That's 2 Samuel 13. 2 Samuel 13. 2 Samuel 13:18. Now she had on a long-sleeved garment, for in this manner the virgin daughters of the king dressed themselves in robes. Then his attendant took her out and locked the door behind her.
Yes, so it shows that she had a sleeved garment which was slightly bit long.
Yes.
And it said that she was a virgin, as he says of Rebecca. She was a virgin.
Yes. So in this manner, the virgin daughters of the king dressed themselves in robes. Robes and long-sleeved garment.
Yes.
To keep modest.
Yes.
For the purpose of staying modest.
Yes.
And discreet.
Yes. So he was gazing probably.
Yes. Because if she were immodestly dressed, then there would be a big contradiction.
Yes.
Right? And also, what about her speech? Other women would be there, right? It was the time when women go out to draw water. And the way she was talking and interacting, if she was saying very much, because she would have been very busy going back and forth, but was she complaining while she was doing it? Was she using curse words while she was doing it? Was she easily distracted by her girlfriends who show up at the well with her? And say, sir, just wait a minute, okay? I need to talk to her about this one recipe. You know, nothing like that. It was dedicated hard work. He was looking and gazing at her behavior for a while she was doing this. What does it say also about his character?
He was being diligent.
He was being diligent. Does the Bible expect us to be quiet and not speak up prematurely? Not decide prematurely? prematurely? Yes. Proverbs chapter 18. Proverbs 18, 2. Proverbs 18, 2. A fool does not delight in understanding, but only in revealing his own mind. A fool does not delight in understanding, but only in revealing his own mind. And 18:13, he who gives an answer before he hears, it is folly and shame to him. Giving an answer before listening is folly and shame. And also Proverbs 29:20. Do you see a man who is hasty in his words? There is more hope for a fool than for him. Therefore, one should not be hasty in words, but know what exactly needs to be said. And in the case of the servant of Abraham, after he gazed in silence for a while, because it would have taken her a while, then he speaks up and makes the proposal in verses 22 and following. Only then. 1 John 4:1-3. Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are from God. Because many false prophets have gone out into the world. By this you know the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is from God, and every spirit that does not confess Jesus is not from God. And this is the spirit of the Antichrist, of which you have heard that it is coming, and now it is already in the world.
He had already seen to her that she said the words that he asked God in his prayer for confirmation on who should he be. But still he watched to see the fruit. He watched to see if she kept her word, to see if she was hardworking and doing it. Also how she was dressed and her conduct with the other people around. So though she had said the right words, he still watched to see what fruit came from.
Yes. Though she said the right words, he waited to see her conduct throughout her watering the camels, to see if she kept her word, if she actually did everything. So he was testing the spirits. He who has ears to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says. Amen.